And I would also like to thank them for bringing to us this morning our next speaker, who is Holly M. from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Holly?
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Holly Martin, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I can't come on to this M stuff. That is for, you know, they tell you. At the level of radio and TV and all that sort of stuff. If you wanted to look me up, you look in a telephone book for Holly M. You'll find me in there, you know. Just go see Holly M. Through the grace of God and this fellowship, I have not found it necessary to take a drink for the last 28 years. Remember, I said, through the grace of God and this fellowship, not Holly M. I once heard at a meeting a speaker, I was told, got up and made that remark that he hadn't found it necessary to take a drink for the past 6 months, and his sponsor was sitting behind him and pulled his coattail and says, "You mean you haven't found it necessary to take a drink in the last 6 months? You were drunk 2 weeks ago." He said, "Yeah, but that wasn't necessary." So maybe sometimes it might happen. But before I go any further, I want to thank you for inviting me here. It's been lovely. And I want to tell you something else. Do you know one thing? You all, there go you all. You people are the nicest, sweetest, kindest, considerate bunch of people that I've met in a long time. You know, everybody's been nice, but the natives are especially nice. You speak to people that you've never seen before. Hello. You make people feel welcome. You stick out your hand and you shake hands. And, have you ever shook hands with a person and you felt like you had just found a wet mackerel in your hand and you wanted to shake? But your handshake is warm and you make me feel welcome. And I want to thank you for that, because you are nice. You're just beautiful, natives and all. I've enjoyed every bit of it. And I'm not going to stand here all morning telling you how wonderful you are, because if you're an alcoholic and you got any kind of ego, you know you're wonderful. You're left to be told that. Many of you that are here, you have told me, "Well, I heard you speak at such and such a time." And you've even stayed over to put up with me again. You know, I'm not going to say anything too much different than what I have said before. But I'll tell you this, if you get a little bored with me, please just stay on, because it'll be something like a little boy that went to school, and he had just been circumcised the day before, and he was very uncomfortable, and he kept squirming in his seat, and the teacher asked him, "What is wrong with you that you don't sit still?" And he wasn't going to tell her that he had just been circumcised, and she sent him down to the principal's office. And the principal said, "What's wrong with you?" And he says, "I'm sick." But he wasn't going to tell him what happened. And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what you do." He says, "Can I go home?" The little fellow asked, "Could he go home?" And the principal says, "No, you cannot go home. Just go back there and sit still." He says, "Well, I can't sit still." He says, "Well, just go back to your room and stick it out till noon." So he went back with his pants down. Literally, not figuratively, vice versa. So bear with me. Thank you, goodness, this is a spiritual meeting. I'm not going to bring you the message according to St. Holly. oftentimes when I'm with my people, which you indeed are, it reminds me very much of the story of the sower, and I'd like to tell you about it. You'll find that in the book of books. It went out to sow the seed, and it tells me that some of the seed fell by the wayside and the birds got it. That to me reminds me of the person that comes into the fellowship, and he I figured he was going to do something like that. Okay. Can you hear me all right? See, I had a big mouth. I can really talk. So we'll start all over again. So the sower went out to sow some seed, and the seed fell by the wayside, and the birds got the seeds and ate them up. And this reminds me very much of the person that comes into the fellowship, and because we don't let him or her rewrite the big book, they fall by the wayside. And the birds will get you, just no doubt about it. And then the sower again goes out to sow seed, and this time the seed falls on very stony ground. And because it doesn't have any depth, it doesn't last very long. And it soon withers out. And this reminds me of the person that says, well, you know, I just can't buy that spiritual part of the program, and he has no depth. And first thing you know, he doesn't last very long. But, you know, we've got something different than what we have in church. You know, if you go and join church and they ask you, do you believe in the spiritual, you say, no, well, you don't get your name on the book. And here we just say, keep on coming back, baby. You'll believe, you know, one of these days. Just keep on coming back. Nobody's going to tell you you can't come back. Just keep on coming. The stony ground means that I have no depth. In other words, I won't listen. Most of the times we learn to listen and listen so we can learn. And then again, the sower goes out to sow seed. And this time the seed falls among the thorns and the thistles. And the thorns and the thistles being so much stronger than the little seed, it soon is beaten down to the earth and it doesn't grow up again. And this reminds me of the person that still, as the big book tells us, thought we could hold on to our old ideas. You know, he goes back to the bar there and he's going to sit on the stool and show everybody how nice he is and how he can sit there amongst these thorns and thistles and not drink, you know. And here's a big old thistle over behind the bar. He's the barkeep, you know, and he's looking at him and he opens his wallet and he's going to tell everybody how prosperous he is. And somebody sees a five in there that he shouldn't have or hasn't been having, and this thorn or thistle will say, hey man, come on, you can have one. And, of course, he's going to have one and going to still show him how nice he can act. Next thing you know, the thorns and thistles have got him. And then again, the sower goes out to sow seed. And this time, the seed falls on very fertile ground and it springs up. You see, when I came into AA, my ground was very fertile. I was steeped in manure there. It was extremely fertile. I'm not going to stand here all morning and give you a blow-by-blow description of my drinking. I don't think that's necessary. Everybody that's an alcoholic or those that aren't, they know exactly how you drink. You open your mouth and you swallow, and that's it. You don't, it's not really and truly necessary. And then sometimes when we hear someone talk, we say, well, you know, I didn't go that far. I had a problem, but maybe it wasn't a bad problem. I just didn't go that far, so we don't compare in here. You know, maybe you didn't go that far. It's not necessary, but then Noah didn't start waiting until it was raining before he built the ark either, you know. He saw it clouding up over there, and he got busy with it. See? But one thing about old Noah, while he was doing it, he sure followed directions. That was sure. And that's what we're asked to do in here. I think I had my first drink when I was about 14 years old, or roundabouts thereof. I was living with my grandparents and my grandfather. There was no practicing alcoholics at that time that I knew of. Well, I had an uncle that drank too much there. My grandmother, she permitted him to make home brew, and she thought that would keep him in the yard or in the house, but the more he drank, the more he made, and the further out he came. So it didn't do any good. But my grandpapa, bless his heart, he had a bottle that he had in a dresser drawer of, he had some whiskey in it, and he had some herbs and, you know, stuff like that. And he drank this for his arthritis. And poor old grandpa would come in crippling, he'd drag that leg in crippling because it hurt so bad, and he'd pull open this dresser drawer and he'd take this bottle out, and he'd take 2-3 swigs out of it, and then grandpapa could walk away. You know, he'd rub his leg first and he could walk away. Well, I saw grandpa do this. And I switched in there one day, and I took a few swigs, and I crippled away the same way that he came in. But lo and behold, I had found a friend. I had found a friend that let me perform. You see, all of my life, see, you people in AA taught me an awful lot. I always had a very deep inferior complex, very deep inferior complex. Are you talking about an inferior complex? I had one. I never felt inferior because I'm black. That's beside the point. I would have felt inferior of the wildest Mau Mau. I just felt inferior, period. Make any difference what it was, I felt inferior. And I felt if you didn't have something people didn't like you, well, They loved me in AA, and I didn't have anything. Instead, I haven't got anything, and everybody loves me. I at least act like they do, and I enjoy them acting like that. I'll tell you that right now, because I love to be loved. And then this sort of thing went on for quite some time. As I said, we won't go by everything that went on. I will say this much, that I had a few friends, that one woman in particular, that she just loved to go out with me when I drank, for the simple reason is, she was, well, 2 days older than Rain, about what old as I am now, and she needed me. Because when we'd go into these drinking places, you know, no self-respecting gentleman would buy the young doll a drink without buying the old doll a drink. And she needed me. You see, I know. I've played on both leagues, too. I know. And she was always helping me with my alcoholism. I was supposed to be helping me with my drinking there, because I would tell her about my hangovers and what was wrong. But she was always, she tried to help me. She said, well, dear, you know, if you don't want to get drunk when we go out at night so quickly, she says, just take a little olive oil, and if you drink that, well, then you won't, don't work. I see you shaking your head. It don't work. She said, if you just take this olive oil and drink this before you go out, she says, you won't get drunk. Well, the only difference that I found in drinking olive oil, instead of being a long, tall, puking drunk, I was a long, tall, greasy, puking drunk. The only thing I could see. And then she would tell me, I'd try to tell her about my hangovers, and she didn't understand that or couldn't. She said, oh, you don't have to wake up feeling like that in the morning if you don't want to. If you just take a bottle of beer and open it and set it down beside the bed and let it get flat and you drink that the first thing in the morning, you won't have a hangover. I don't know where that works, and there's no way in the world I could go to sleep with a full bottle of beer sitting down beside the bed. I don't know. Maybe it works, maybe it don't, I don't know. It didn't work for me. And so I had a pretty miserable time there convincing myself of that. And so then, you know, I had someone tell me, well, you know what somebody was always telling me what I really needed in my life. That was one of the things. Somebody told me that, what you really need in your life is religion. And somebody else told me, well, what you really need in your life is companionship, and I tried all of that, and all of them backfired on me, because I wound up with two religions and somebody else's companion, and all three of them backfired. So didn't work. See, marriages are like vaccinations on me, they don't take. They just didn't work. I don't know how it works. But anyhow, I had two lovely children. I mean, I have two lovely children. They're just gorgeous, you know. It was amazing. That's what helped make my day this morning, besides you people, my daughter lives here in San Francisco, and I had told her, and she called me. I said, well, I'll be on Mother's Day. I said, I'll be in Reno, Nevada. And that's all I said. She works for the Department of Agriculture, something or other there. And she called me this morning. She says, Happy Mother's Day, Mother. I said, Leslie, how in the world? I told you I'd be in Reno, but this isn't Reno. It's Sparks or something or other. And how'd you know I'd be at this hotel? She says, well, Mother, I'm supposed to be an investigator in the Department of Agriculture. If you can't find your own mother, you can't find nothing. And so, which made me feel so good, you know, really. Everything is just as it should be. God's in his heaven and all right with the world. You better believe it. Well, nevertheless, I'm back to my tale of woe here. Finally, I'm not going to go into that marriage either, because he was a gambler and he was drinking and throwing it away faster than I could drink it up, and I couldn't put up with that. So I kept my two kids, and he had to go. See, it was either my way or the highway. That was the kind of person I was anyway. And oh, how I loved my children dearly. I'm telling you, really. In the only way that I knew as an alcoholic how to love anybody, say. I am so glad again for this fellowship, because I was the most possessive person this side of heaven. And this program has taught me that you let go and let God, not only of all problems, you know, and I would have been still holding on to those children, and that's not the way you do it. They have grown up to be beautiful people. And I was talking with my son not too long ago, and I was praising him for what a fine young man that he is. Well, he's not young, he's old now. And he said, well, Mother, there was something in our home that you gave us in spite of your drinking. I said, what was that? He said, you loved us. And I was amazed. I did, but I didn't recognize that it was any, after I have grown up a bit, that it was any kind of love. It was still a possessive love. But then on the other hand, you see, I didn't beat the dickens out of my kids. I wasn't always hitting them upside the head. Because when you've got a hangover, who's going to hit a kid and hear him holler? You don't do that. You give him a quarter and send him to the show. So, and then furthermore, you do let them have their own way to a certain extent because you feel guilty. And if you wake up in the morning and they wake up and you ask them what they want for breakfast and they say popsicles, you give them popsicles. You don't have to cook any popsicle. So they got away with a lot of things. They want to call it love. Okay, fine. Now I know the meaning of love. See? But I think it was tinged in a little something else right along through there. But that's okay. They know I love them now. Well, nevertheless, let me get back to how I got into this fellowship after getting into everything else. You know, AA is the only thing in my life I've never got put out of. When I was going to school, I was always being expelled. Constantly. I remember growing up in Ohio, and I got put out of school so many times. My grandmother went to school one time. She told the principal, she says, as long as there's a school in the state of Ohio, Holly's going. And he said, in that case, we'll secede from the union then. We're not going to have it. And so I went to all kinds of schools. I don't know. I resented authority. I couldn't be bothered going to school. And that sort of thing. And, if I wasn't being expelled, was being excommunicated. I guess I got married too many times in church or something or other there. That didn't work out too well. So I was going to be extinguished if I don't do something about my drinking. It happened. This beautiful thing happened on a Saturday night. See, I don't have a fantastic story to tell you about my drinking because, I wound up drinking wine, and I'm not a wino. Women are not winos. They're winettes. That's what it was, a winette. One Saturday night, I was sitting at home. After many of my escapades, see, I want to talk to you about steps. That's what I really want to tell you. I love those steps, you know. This particular Saturday night, a story came on the radio. It was called The Glass Crutch. It was about a woman that had a drinking problem. Now, if it had been about a man that had a drinking problem, I wouldn't pay any attention to it. All men I knew had problems. If they knew me, they had a problem. And so it said, if you ever need our help, we'll be the first number in the book. Well, I thought, I don't ever need those people's help. I was sitting there drinking my wine fine. But, you know, if any of you have ever read The Hound of Heaven, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about, because if he wants you, he's going to get you. You'd better believe it. Now, that was 6 or 7 years prior to my coming into the fellowship that I heard the story. So I'll tell you today, when a seed has been planted, say, within somebody in the ground is the least bit fertile. It's going to do something's going to happen, it's the least bit fertile. Okay. I can remember walking down the street at certain times. It didn't happen every week or every month or every day. Certain animals, the heel plates on my shoes would beat out the words, the glass crutch. You know, I was always hearing things anyway, so, you know. And finally, I can remember hearing the clock go tick-tock, tick-tock. Instead of saying that, it said, the glass crutch. So I thought. One day, I was reading the newspaper. It seemed as if every word on that newspaper said, the glass crutch. So finally, in dismay, I dropped the paper. I looked down on my hand and it dawned on me what the glass crutch really meant. Holly Martin, you can't even down read the newspaper without the glass crutch. There I was. Trying to read the newspaper upside down with a glass of wine in my hand. Now, it would sound beautiful to say immediately I dropped the glass and I ran to the phone. I did no such thing. As if there was anything wrong with Holly, she can straighten it out. You know? Finally, that day came. That I looked in the book, and it was just as they said, if you ever need our help, we'll be the first number in the book. I said, I'm going to catch them in a lie. They ain't going to be there. Sure enough, first number in the book, called up. Now, I didn't know all the terminology that they used. You know, this lady asked me, are you having a problem with your drinking? Well, no, I don't have any problem with my drinking. I can drink it, but I have no problem about it. So finally, she got my name out of me, and at first I lied, and she says, well, do you need some help? I said, oh, no, goodbye. Then I called back again, and I said, I got a friend out here. I think she's losing her mind. I said, would you have somebody come out and talk to her? The lady said, would you like to have somebody talk to you? I said, oh, no. Finally, I told her the truth. She said, someone will call you, and she did. A lady called me, and she said, now, if you got anything out there to drink, you get rid of it. I did. I drank it up, and... She said she was coming, and she came. That woman told me one of the most magnificent things I'd ever heard in my life, and I'm going to tell this to you right now. Right away, I began to tell her, I've got to do something about my drinking on account of my children. She said, you do something on the account of you. Your children will be okay. Yeah, that woman told me the truth. You do something on account of you. Not on account of your children. Because the first time your kids make you mad, you're going to get drunk. See? First time you're going to, if you're going to try to stay sober for anybody other than yourself, the first time they cross you, you're going to say, look what I give up for you. You know? I threw up on your account, but I'm not going to give up on your account. I don't do that, see? So, nevertheless, she's going to take me to that first meeting. Alcohol is everything the big book says it is, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Now, I had reached by now the state of zombieism. That is, if you drink, you don't get drunk. If you don't drink, you don't get sober. If you've ever been in the state of zombieism, nothing happens one way or the other, you know? But, you know, cunning, babbling, and powerful, about 45 minutes or sometime or other before time me to go to that first meeting, two of my dear lush-head buddies came by, and they gave me a couple of drinks and was the same as pouring coal oil on the dying embers. I got drunk. But she took me. Well, she took me to that first meeting. Four girls jumped up and says, wasn't too many women in AA at that time where I came from. But anyhow, these other girls jumped up and says, we'll help you with it. They thought they was going to get to be my pallbearers. I did look awful bad, you know. So, where are my sponsors? You know, I was scared of that woman. She had buck teeth. And I thought she's going to bite me. And I felt about that woman the way some people, you know, right after I had called and I got to thinking about this, I felt about that woman like, and that sponsor of mine, like some men feel about their wives at times, and vice versa. I wish the hell you'd go away and leave me alone, but don't go so far I can't find you if I need you. You know, one of those kind of things. But she was constantly always dragging this who me out on me. Oh, dude. She'd look at me and she'd buck them teeth and she'd say, just answer yes to three, dear, and you're in. I thought, this old biddy must be getting 50 cents a yes. And she said, is drinking clouding your reputation? Well, if you've been in the fog over 20 years, you know it's cloudy or not. Then she'd say, do you seek a lower environment while drinking? Oh, I merely created a lower environment while drinking. And then she asked one of the dumbest questions you could ever ask on this devilish who me. Do you prefer to drink alone? If I'm buying it, yes. If you're buying it, no. The way I felt about that, you know. Stupid boy. Okay. And, you know, people sponsored a lot different in those days than they did now. You know, now you sidle up to somebody, would you like to go to a meeting tonight? Oh, they didn't do that then. Look, broad, be ready, we're going to meeting tonight. Okay. And if you watch out, they'll tell you what kind of broad you were, too. Now they call you a lady. You know. Nevertheless, things begin to go on beautifully. And one of the things I begin to find in this fellowship, that you meant what you said, you know? And one of my dear old sponsors used to always say, now, dear, just stick with the winners. They have something. And I noticed one day, you know, I said, I attended bar before I came in this fellowship. I believed in on-the-job training. That's why I attended bar. And I always stuck with the winners there. You know, when I was in the bar, I stuck with the winners. You know, the people that always had money, I stuck with them. And with these people in AA that always stay sober, I try to stick with them, and that's what I tried to do. And made it. You know, one of the things, as time went on and I began to look at these beautiful 12 steps, I learned that each one of them brought me a message. Each one, see. They brought me a message. Just like, and I will try this morning if I can, to identify these 12 steps as the 12 disciples, because they brought me a message, you know? And that is what is so important. When I looked at that first step where we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable, see, it brings me a message. It reminds me so much of a disciple. What is a disciple? A disciple is one that has learned discipline. And that's one of the things that I have to learn is discipline because my life is unmanageable. See, it's discipline. And then a disciple is one that has learned how to listen. And then he becomes an apostle because he listens so he can learn. And that's what happens to us here. First, we learn how to listen, you know, because I didn't know how to listen to nothing. Then I begin to listen so I can learn something. But first, I got to learn how to listen. One of the best ways for me to learn how to listen was to shut up. You can't learn nothing if you're in your mouth all the time. So I had to learn how to listen. And I had sponsors that, you know, they didn't bite their tongue and tell you to shut up either. If they didn't verbally or orally tell you to shut up, they'd haul up and kick your foot under the table, you know. And, you know, every time you go home, you had to run in your stocking, whether it doesn't kick the dickens out of his shin under the table there, you know. So, and then every time that I tried to tell them how I felt, I hadn't learned how to tell truth then, you know. We had that group, great big old heavy cups. And when you start lying, everybody starts stirring in the cup, looking up at the ceiling. And I'd say, don't you believe me? And they'd say, do you? And I said, oh, hell. But see, I found people just like me there. So I learned how to listen. And I learned how to put some discipline in my life. Because this first step reminds me very much of an apostle that by the name of Peter. He brings me the message of humility. If you can remember, and I know you know the story of Peter, he was one of those impulsive, impetuous, loud-mouthed, boisterous type of people. He was a born leader, but his life was very, very unmanageable. And in spite of all of this outward display, at heart, he was a coward. You know? You know, I can identify with this man and his emotions up to this point because, you see, our divine Lord had told Peter, he says, you're going to deny me three times. And Peter says, oh, no, 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 not me. How do I can identify with that? How many times haven't I said, I'm not going to drink anymore. And somebody says, oh, yes, you will. You'll be drunk before the sun goes down. Oh, no, 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 not me. I am through. This is it. But why? What really and truly happened? Like Peter, you see, out of fear, the fear of being ridiculed, see, the fear of somebody pointing a finger at me, the fear of not being accepted. And like Peter, the first time that Peter was asked, were you not with the Galilean? Peter said, no, no, I wasn't. The second time. The maiden said, were you not with the gal? Oh, no, not me. The third time he was asked, what happened to Peter? He began to curse and swear. No, 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 he said. How many times hasn't this same thing happened to me? Somebody said, hey, I thought you weren't going to drink anymore. Oh, well, I'm just going to have one. Second time, well, I didn't tell you forever. Third time, you lose your cool. Look, you mind your own business. I know what I'm doing. You know? You see, the thing of it was this. When I made that assertion, like Peter, I was not prepared for the time of testing when I would be asked. And I was afraid, and I was a coward, to say no, thank you. I was afraid of being not accepted, afraid of being ridiculed. And many times, like Peter, I found myself warming my hands by the fire with the centurion. Oh, after saying that I was not going to drink or I wasn't going to do this, here I'm going into a bar. And every time that I went into that bar, after making this assertion that I was not going to drink, I was only warming my hands by the fire with the centurion, you know? If I would take the bottle home, I'm not telling you don't take it home. I'm talking about Holly Martin. If I take it home and say, I'm just going to keep this till my friends come over, I'm warming my hands by the fire with the centurion because I'm going to drink that. I know me, see. My life is unmanageable, and I am powerless over alcohol, see. You think your life still is unmanageable as it used to be? Through God's help and the help of this fellowship, I'm allowed, or I'm privileged, shall we say, to cope with it. But I'm also chicken. And I'd rather be chicken than what comes out of the end of a chicken, you know? See, I don't mind when someone says, oh, you don't want to have a drink, you chicken, that's all right, you know, you call me that, call me. And then someone, well, why don't you drink? I said, I've had enough, really and truly. Well, don't you ever drink? I said, not when I'm sober. So, you see, my friends, like Peter, every time before I came into this fellowship that I said I wasn't going to drink and I did, like him after my denial, I was full of self-loathing. I was full of remorse. And we are told that Peter, after his denial, that he wept bitterly. Haven't you done the same thing? After you promise somebody with all of your heart, I'll never do this again. And you do it again and you again and again. And you hate yourself and you're full of remorse, full of self-loathing. Till finally, through his divine grace, you and I are pulled up out of that well. And you say, well, you know, after all, I never got in jail and all of those kind of things, so why should I have felt that way? There's not an alcoholic in the world, my friends, if he or she's a true alcoholic that hasn't been in jail. What worse prison is it? Well, the walls is made out of pride and the bars is made out of fear and you sleep on a couch of remorse and you get up every morning and put on the only garment you own. One of self-pity. Yeah. If that isn't a jail, and you are your own warden. Yeah. And you can't forgive yourself. And you crawl right back in there again. So this first step, being the first disciple, brings me the message of humility, teachability. See, putting a little discipline into my life. And then the second step, where we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Thomas. I often think of Thomas. Belief by experience. You know, many times a person might tell you, well, I just can't buy this spiritual. Well, it's not for sale. If it was, I'll be on the welfare. It isn't for sale. You know what I'm saying? Many times we may use this as an attention getter. Because if you don't believe in something, what the heck you keep harping on it for? You know, you ever take a person and say, I just don't believe it, and he keeps talking about it all the time. You want me to convince you that you do believe, but you don't want to admit that you believe? You know, sometimes we don't want to believe in a power greater than ourselves because it might, or we don't want to admit that we believe because there's a possibility that it might incur or mean some kind of change, and we don't like to change, you know? And if I believe, come to believe in the power greater than myself, I'm going to have to accept responsibility, and I don't want to do that. So if I play crazy, I will not be expected to act sane, you know? We might have to change. And then I have also met the person that says, well, you know, I don't need a power greater than myself. I'm a self-made man. I said, no wonder you screwed up. You did it yourself, you know? Self-made, you know. So I came to believe, I've always believed in a power greater than myself, that to me is God. But to trust God. For some reason or other, this business of trusting, I don't know. Like Thomas, Thomas said, I can believe if I can but touch his hand. The nail prints in his hand. If I can just touch his side, I can believe it then. Believe by experience. And our divine Lord said to Peter, stretch hither thy hand. And Thomas, I beg your pardon, and Thomas, through his doubt, he stretched hither his hand. You know, just his hand. Stretch hither thy hand, Thomas. And Thomas did this. You see, if you and I can just reach out, stretch hither your hand. If you want a taxi, you stand on the street. You don't just stand there like an idiot. You stretch out your hand. And when the taxi stops, it don't just ride your hand. It takes all of you. You know? Yes. It's all of you. So you see, my friends, this is what happened to me. It's just like Brill cream. A little dab will do you. You know? You need that little dab. You say, well, how do I find this? What signs were the signs that I see in the fellowship? You know, it was just like a woman. This woman had been sick for a number of years, 18, I believe. And she said, she had tried everything under the sun. She'd went, you know, the Book of Books says that she, having spent all, that means everything. She didn't have nothing left, having spent all. And how many of us, having spent all, you've got nothing left. So what have you got to lose? She'd probably, in those days, went to see soothsayers and medicine men and everything else. And finally, she saw our divine Lord in the crowd. And she said, if I can just but touch the hem of his garment. She did. And she was made whole. After having spent all, she had nothing else. And that was what I was. I had nothing else to believe in. Oh, as I said, I believed in God, you know. See, Thomas wanted to know that he knew, And that's the problem with a lot of us. You believe. But you want to make sure that you believe what you believe. That's it. You just want to, you want to be reassured that you believe what you believe. But sometimes we won't try it until after having spent all. But see, the book says so. You know, the book says God could and would if he were sought. That he could and he would if he were sought. Well, let's take the God bit out of the 12 steps. Well, you got about four left. You can't get very far on four of anything nowadays, you know. So, you start down that escalator, them steps down there, any steps around here, and you say, well, look, I'm going to take them all out before. Now, you try to get to the bottom, baby, you're going to fall through the hole there. Well, it happens every time, you know. And then that third step, we have a disciple by the name of Matthew. His name was Levi to begin with. He brings me the message of a decision. And I'll tell you why. See, Matthew, whose name at that particular time was Levi, was a tax collector. He didn't like his job. He didn't like anything. He didn't like the people he associated with. I can identify with him. I did not like the people that I drank with. I couldn't stand most of them, you know. If I saw them coming and they didn't have a brown bag in their hand, I didn't let them in, you know. If I went to their house and they didn't have anything to drink, I didn't stay. I'd act like on Sunday morning early, you know, you get over and you go over. You know, you don't go to visit nobody early on Sunday morning. You know, you say, oh, I just thought I'd stop by to see you. You know, you're lying. You don't stop by to see nobody early on. You stop by to see if you had anything to drink. If you didn't have anything to drink, you keep on going, don't you? You know? One of those kind of things. I've had people pull that con off on me. Oh, girl, I just happened to be in the neighborhood. At 5 o'clock in the morning, you're in the neighborhood? Don't make sense. One of those kind of things. So you keep on going. Well, here was poor old Matthew. Bless his heart. He was sitting down beside the road being a tax collector, and he hated the Roman Empire, he hated the government, he hated everybody. But he had nowhere else to turn, nobody else to associate with. See, people, nice people, had long quit associating with me. They didn't want to have anything to do with me. And so here comes Holly Hyde, the whiskey. They didn't want to, you know, have nothing to do with me. I can understand that. They always thought I was going to puke on the rug, which I probably would have. I don't know. Something, or break something, or do something. So here's that's Matthew, bless his heart. And our divine Lord came by this day. See, he was disturbed by his present life, but he didn't know what to do about it. Before you and I came into this fellowship, from time to time we were disturbed, but we didn't know what to do. And here's that Matthew, and our divine Lord came by and he says, come follow me. That's all he told Matthew, come follow me. And the book of books says that Matthew straightway left everything. Because he had found a way. Decision. Immediately. He didn't say, well, Lord, you go on down the street. I'll pick up on you a little bit later. Leave your number. See, Matthew had found a way out. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Found a way out. That was it. What in the world? And sometimes, you know, big deal. You think, oh, I've made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Big deal. Who else really and truly wants the will and the life of an alcoholic? I don't know of anybody that wants it, you know. See, a man or a woman that doesn't take a stand for something will fall for anything. You know that. All of my life, I wonder, what do I do next? I wanted out, but I didn't know how to get out. The third step, made a decision. Something that alcohol had never, ever permitted me to do was make a decision. Alcohol never allowed me to make any decisions. You say, well, you know, have you ever fell down on the floor and you tried to get up in the bed and it was going around that way and you say, I'll catch it next time it comes back. You know, you make any decisions. One of those kind of things. You're sitting down, you should get up and go to the bathroom and sometimes alcohol says, no, you won't go. You're all right, right here. And that's what happens. You don't have the privilege of decision. How many times did alcohol knock me to my knees and I couldn't get up? Morning, noon, and night, I can get down on my knees and through the grace of God, I can get up. And say, thank you, God. Thank you. You know. So, the third step offers me gives me the message of decision. I no longer have to worry or fret. What do I do next? I leave it in his hands every time. Sometimes, you know, I say, well, you know, it seems like with all that I have to do, God works me like I am the only person he knows. But he turns right around and takes care of me like I'm the only child he's got, you know, which evens things out for me. Now we have another disciple or apostle. His name is Philip. Made a searching and thorough moral inventory of ourselves. Philip was known as the common sense apostle. You know, you just don't throw a silk blanket over a mule and make a racehorse out of it. You don't do that. You're going to have to do some thinking here.
No.
Searching and fearless. See, Philip was in one of these little towns by the seaside there. It was a rowdy little town. You know, a lot of gambling went on in that town, I'm told. Debauchery and whatnot. Present company accepted. And anyhow, that's why my hat's off to you people. You're really great, I'm telling you. All of you are like Philip. You've got common sense. Man, at least you showed me. So anyway, Philip knew that but he was running away. Our divine Lord found Philip. He was running away. See? He knew that something had to change and he couldn't change the town. So Philip knew that he had to change himself. And he knew that pretense wasn't going to do any good. So he made a searching and fearless moral inventory of himself. And he found out, I am the person that must change. See? And when he found the master, God could and would if he were sought. And he knew that he had found the right answer. He turned to his friend Nathaniel, and he said great words. When Nathaniel says, what good can come out of Galilee? And Philip says, come and see. Greatest words of ever said, come and see. In other words, when someone says, what good is it going to do for me to take an inventory? I'm sober. Come and see. Take one and see. Come and see. What good is it going to do me to go to AA? I've been running all my life. Take the words of common sense, Philip. Come and see. Yeah. You might find something there. See, if I'm going to stay in AA, well, I won't be in AA. If I'm going to just not drink, let's put it this way. And I'm not going to practice any of the principles of the program. I'm not going to go to AA, but I'm not drinking until I'm on a dry drunk. If you don't believe me, go and see. Because that's exactly what'll happen. And then there is Jude. He brings me the message of self-forgiveness. Fifth step. Admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. You know, Judas, many of us today, because we cannot forgive ourselves, like Judas, we hang ourselves by the rope of self-condemnation. We'll go around and you'll say, well, Almighty God has forgiven you. Well, why can't you forgive yourself? Oh, I just simply can't forgive myself. Are you greater than Almighty God that you can't forgive yourself? Oh, how could I have done this because you are a human being? Yeah. Exact nature. See, Judas, so great was his guilt that he could not look at himself. So great was his guilt, he could not forgive himself. And he went out and he hung himself. And that is what we can find ourselves doing, you know. See, this thing of denial, rather than to face the truth. In other words, exact nature of my wrongs, my motive. What was my motive? Whatever it was. See, many times, my friends, when I look at the motive for what I have done, there is an entirely different thing about it. My motive for stealing. Did I steal because I was hungry or did I steal because I was greedy? You say, well, stealing is stealing. Let us look at the motive, the exact nature of my wrong. There's many times that loneliness could have been the exact nature of my wrongs. I got into a lot of things because I was a lonely person. Does that excuse me? But I was lonely. I permitted loneliness to take over because I'd alienated myself from everybody that was decent. And I wound up a very lonely person. Exactly. Oh, I'd come back and I'd lie about it. Oh, I was down there doing this thing and that thing. Oh, man, I was having a ball. I was down there because I wasn't accepted anyplace else. And I was lonely. And human beings, being such as they are, do get lonely. Exact nature of my wrongs. But whatever it is, if God can forgive me, which he does, then I must forgive myself rather than to constantly hang myself. And then we have this little bitty step. We think it's little, but it isn't. It is none of them a little to me. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. We have an apostle that brings us this message, the message of truth. Entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Simon the Zealot, who had been a guerrilla warfare fighter, as you might would call him as today, he found that the truth was mightier than the sword. And how you and I, when hit with the truth, sometimes we want to hit back and hurt because the truth can cut so deeply. And as I cannot find the truth until I take a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. You know, and many times we say, well, look, entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I don't want to get rid of this. I got one character defect I want to hold on to. You. Oh, yeah. In other words, are you happy with it? Are you happy with pride? Are you happy with fear? Are you happy with resentment? If some, you see, these things hurt. If you went to the doctor and he said, look, your appendix have got to come out. You say, oh, no. I want to hold on to them. They're going to hurt you. And when I hold on this, oh, how many times? Well, you know, if I give up this anger of mine, well, then I lose my identity. Isn't that a duck? You mean I got to walk around mad? Or I will lose my identity. Well, I'm known for my sharp tongue. And if I give this up, then I lose my identity. I've seen people get their throat cut on the count of their identity, too. You know what I mean? You say, mm-mm. Well, you know, sometimes I'd better let go of that identity. And then we do have a very little guy. He was an apostle. And his name was Nathaniel Bartholomew. To thine own self be true. He was one of these kind of people. You see, when we humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Little bitty things. Not big at all. You see, Nathaniel Bartholomew, he was one of those small, very insignificant people in a crowd of people. You'd rarely notice him. He was so little. That's where our shortcomings are. They're so small, and you don't just pay a lot of attention to them. But they are there. That is the detonator that sets off the bomb. Those are the clothespins that hold the, shall we say, resentments on the clothesline. That little pretty thing, you know. See, Peter pretended, and because of his pretense, he was found cussing and swearing. Yeah. And if I pretend, oh, I don't have any shortcomings, none whatsoever. You know, if I would go home today and there'd be a bomb in my living room. Well, so what would I do? Well, first I would tip in real quietly like, and I'd take the phone and I would tip out in the hall and I would dial 911 and say, would you, I don't like policemen. I mean, I love them, but I mean, you know, I've never been real fond of them, let's put it that way. And I'd say, look, would you please come up to my apartment? I think there's a bomb in here. See, in that 7th, we're to humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. I wouldn't get on that phone and say, hey, man, come over and get this bomb. Oh, no. Real kind and cool, would you please? That's the round about these character defects. Now, sure, Lord, would you please? I know they're small and they're insignificant, but the book of books says, beware of the little foxes that gnawed our vineyards because our vines have tender grapes. And my grapes are so tender that they will ferment at the slightest provocation. You know, so I have to watch that, you know. And then, whoops, lost my card there. You know, see, I'm getting old. I have to have some cards because you get my age, but, you know, I'm going to tell you how old I am. I'm 2 days older than Rain. That'll do. Yeah. Now, let us briefly look at steps 8 and 9, James and John. They were the sons of thunder, but they bring us a message of love. Amends. When we speak of amends, the first amend that I must make is with myself. I must have peace within me. How can I bring peace to you if I don't have peace within myself? See, James and John, the sons of thunder, they loved tremendously, tremendously. You know, sometimes I have to, in taking my inventory, I have to think of what a hypocrite that I was. How I would like to come to you to make peace with you so I could get close to you to do the same thing over again. Always. How many times but today when one goes to make amends, when I speak of one, I'm speaking of this one, you know? I don't go saying, well, now look, I want you to realize that I did thus and so forth, you know, if I owe you some money. Well, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and now I'm going to make amends, and I'm going to pay money. I want you to know, a man don't care about you being an alcoholic. He wants his money, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and I have found God. That's wonderful, but he wants you to find his money. You know, he don't care who you found, you know, see. And I don't want anyone to make me feel less than what I am. The big book says I don't crawl, see. I don't believe in condescension. I could never, see, I would make a very poor martyr, see. I couldn't be a martyr, not in the least. I believe in the principle of obedience, not martyrdom. Because, you see, if I become a martyr, which would be very hard for me to do, I'm going to be thinking while I'm being a martyr, how can I get even with you for making me a martyr, see. So I have to watch that, see. Because deep within Holly, that old Holly is still trying to get out again, you know? Well, I have to watch this kind of stuff. Restoration without reservation. That is what I have to look for. Now, if I'm coming to you to make amends and I want you to just forgive me on the grounds that I am an alcoholic, well, I did these things because I am an alcoholic. I have to go back again to the fourth step where I made a searching and fearless moral inventory of me. It says of ourselves, not what kind of skunk I was when I was drinking, but what kind of skunk are you drunk or sober, Holly? You know? Oh, well, you know, I wasn't doing this or that. El Toro poo-poo. You know, you were doing this, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't want you to give me a break because I'm an alcoholic. See, I want you to love me because I am a child of God. I don't want condescension, you know? I want respect, and I can only get it by earning it. Many times one might have fear of amends because we are afraid for people to find out that we are human. We don't want anyone to know that we are human, because we are afraid if someone finds out that I am a human being, they will expect me to act like one. Then I have to be superior. I have to have an inferior way of showing my superiority, which I can really do. And then there is the tenth step. Continue to take personal inventory. Continue. There was a disciple whose name was Jude Thaddeus. He brings me the message of steadfastness. Now, his name was just Jude until they finally hitched on Jude Thaddeus to separate him from the other Jude, the betrayer. Now, you would think, how many times has this man who has the name of Jude Thaddeus, how he felt about this? He might very easily could have said, oh, look, after the way this other Jude has performed, I might as well get out of this. Because everybody's going to say he's got the same name he's got. But he hung in there, steadfast, continued to take a personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted, steadfast. Hang in there. You know, somebody's always going to tell you, oh, you that thing you belong to, you know, I knew another guy that was an alcoholic, and you know what he did? Mm-hmm. And they tell me what you people do. I said, look, I don't want to hear that. Just go tell that to somebody else. But I'm going to tell you, this alcoholic I knew, honey, now he went to that thing, and I'm going to tell you what really happened to him. I said, I don't want to know what happened to him. I want to find out what's going to happen to me, you know. And you keep on bothering me, I'm going to let you know what's going to happen to you. You know, so don't bother me about it, see? Please. And it's going to happen to you because I love you, and that's one of my ways of expressing my love, you see? Mm-hmm. See? Do you know one thing? If you don't watch him, he's going to ruin the program. He might ruin his program, but he ain't going to ruin my program, you know. This is my program. You can't ruin my program. He can ruin his own program. I'd say he has a right to ruin it if he wants to. It's his. And this is mine, but he don't have a right to ruin mine. Say, continue. I must continue to be steadfast. I must continue to be steadfast so that I can grow, regardless of what any other alcoholic might have said or done. That's him or her. See, I must continue to put credit where credit belongs and take none for myself. You know, when one begins to take credit for himself, he gets into a lot of trouble. He might hit bottom. You know, one day, two geese were fixing to fly south, and it was a frog. And they were talking it over. These geese were talking it over about flying south. It was cold, and this frog heard them. And the frog says, "Please, may I go along?" And they told the frog, "You can't fly. How can you go?" And the frog says, "Oh, please take me." So the geese, they got their heads together, and they said, "Well, maybe we can take him." So they found a corn stalk in the cornfield, and one of them says, "Now, I'll put one end in my mouth, and you put the other," he's talking to the other geese or goose or whatever you call them, and he says, "And you put that end in your mouth." And he told the frog, he says, "Now, you hang on in the middle. Keep your mouth shut, hang on in the middle." So down the road they go. There's two hunters out there, and they looked up in the sky, and they saw this apparition going down the street, down the road. And one of them says, "That is unique." And he says, "I wonder who thought that up." And old frog said, "I did." You know where he went. When we start thinking about what I did, his fanny hit it. So really, my friends, I cannot take credit. I must just continue to do what I have been taught to do each and every day. And then there is the beautiful 11th step. Now, this man, he wrote a gospel, but he was not a disciple that walked with our divine Lord, because he came along a lot later. But I think he's so very appropriate for the 11th step. His name is Luke. He wrote one of the four gospels. He was a physician. You see, Luke went right to the very source for his information because he had to, because he did not walk as the other disciples walked with our Lord, as I said before, he came after. So he had to go to the very places. And that's what this 11th step teaches me. Sought through prayer and meditation. Isn't that the source of it? Prayer and meditation, my friends, that's the source of it. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. Praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. That's something, isn't it? Only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that. See, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. You see, it's the power. You know, we read the story of David that slew Goliath. And here's this, and each and every one of us has got a Goliath out there. He's out there, you'd better believe it. And here goes little David out there with his slingshot. Yeah, but he had a belief, you know. But he went right to the source with his belief. You and I know very good and well, see, that it was not the source behind that slingshot that slew Goliath. But it was the power of God. You and I go out there each and every day armed with what we have. And we go to the source. Prayer and meditation. Praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it out. That is exactly where it is. You know, as long as I stay in AA, I will feel that I'm always in the recovery room. Because I have had a great operation. All of that. We have had one of the greatest operations that one can have when one has the kind of operation that you and I have had, a personality operation, say. You know, when one has had a severe operation, he or she is put in a recovery room. And there's always a very efficient nurse there that has taken your full vital signs. And at the slightest deviation of any of them, she will call for a physician. And you and I, when while we are in, shall we say, the recovery room of AA, I am constantly watching my four vital signs. Pride, fear, resentment, and self-pity. See? And I don't need to send out for a nurse. I can get in touch with the greatest of all physicians right then and there. If I'm walking down the street, I can get in touch. You say, well, do you stop and fall down on your knees in the middle of the street? No, but my heart kneels. Because one of my vital signs has got out of fix. and I will always be in the recovery room because I sought through prayer and meditation to improve. You see, I cannot improve upon a relationship unless I know the person. And there's where that second and third step come in. You know, you got to know the person. You got to know the doctor. You don't have to look in the yellow pages. If something hurts you bad enough, you ain't going to look in no yellow pages. You know, you want word of mouth. What did he do? And that's what we give you here. That's why we keep telling you, keep on coming back. Don't look in the yellow pages. You know? That's the reason why I commented to my friend, oh, you can read. You see, I could tell by talking with him, but he had been reading something beside the white. He had been reading the black on there, too. You know, and that helped. That helped him a lot. He's been reading there. So now we find one of the greatest of all disciples, Andrew. He wrote no book. You will not find in none of the 66 books, you will not find no book of Andrew, you know. But he brings me the message of determination. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry the message. You see, Andrew, no book ever written, but Andrew made the first 12-step call because he brought Peter. But you know who Andrew brought first? He brought Andrew. That's what you and I have to do. Until you bring yourself, you can't bring your brother. You know? You know, sometimes a person does not want to be brought. And what does the book say? Well, if he doesn't want to be brought, you go on and get somebody that wants to be brought. Don't keep monkeying around and maybe missing the chances for a better time. You know, once there was an eagle out there. Oh, he was a beautiful eagle, and he was feeling his wings, and he felt, you know, oh, so cool. And his strength and his power, and he saw a seal, and the seal had come up out of the water, and the seal was laying on the bank, and he figured, now that seal shouldn't be laying there in all of that muck and mud. I think I'll go down there and get that seal out. So down flew the eagle in all of his glory, and he stuck his talons into the seal. The seal didn't want to come out of there. And the eagle became frustrated. And the more he tried to pull the seal out, the more the flesh of the seal closed in on the eagle's talons. You see, any time you and I grasp on to something that too firmly that we don't know what we are doing, and this can be in any relationship, that wants to go the other way, I've got to let them go the other way. Because one of the disciples said one time, to the master, how far do I go with my fellow man? And the master said, to the edge of the pit. He didn't say about falling off down in there with him, you know. He didn't say about that, you know. Then that happens. Yeah. So, you see, this seal, these talons was hurting the seal. And the seal was trying to get away. You see, sometimes when we stick our talons in to people that we love, places that we love, they want to get away from you because you're hurting them. And if you don't let go, they're going to pull you right off down in the muck with them, just like that seal pulled that eagle out in the water and drowned him. It happens, see. So, do what the book says. Release my talons and go on and work somewhere else and don't spoil my chances. You know. And this is what Andrew did. Andrew, we will find Andrews in all of our programs. These are the people who rarely are ever seen out in front. They're always the ones that's behind the scene, setting up chairs, making coffee, doing this, doing that. These are the Andrews. They're busy people, but they're very important people. These are the people, shall we say, that are real, true helpers. We all are. But an Andrew, and he brought his brother, the greatest of all apostles. You never once heard where Andrew got jealous of Peter either. He still kept right on doing what he had to do, carrying the message the best way that he knew how to do it. And you know, there's something about Andrew and carrying his message, and all 12 of them, none of them had a PhD. None of them had a master's degree. They didn't. Of course, I got a PhD, piled up hell and damnation. I got mine, see. But you know, my friends, how much of a PhD do I need to tell you about the love of God. How much of a master's degree do I need to tell you that God don't want you to mess up yourself with alcohol? I don't need a PhD. I'm not saying these things are wrong now. Don't get me wrong. But in order to carry this simple message, all I need to be a disciple is to wear the badge that he gave me. You know, we all are disciples. And you will say, well, how will others know that I am a disciple? By what our divine Lord said. You see, we all wear badges telling what we are. And sometimes the badge that we wear, other people see behind the badge. And that's the badge that our master gave us. And what badge shall you and I wear that all people will know that we are disciples? And that's the last commandment that he gave us. A new commandment that I give you. That you love one another. By this will all men know that you are my disciples. God bless you.